I'm going to make this opening just as short as I can because I want to give our speaker all the time that she needs or wants. It is my great pleasure to be asked to introduce this alcoholic woman. I've known her several years now, and the first time we met, I chaired a meeting in Hot Springs at the Arkansas State Convention, and I introduced her on Friday night as the Friday night speaker, and I met her at the airport here in Little Rock, and we drove to Hot Springs together and spent the weekend together off and on. And to know her is to love her. She is one of those people who is just a very, very special person. She has a distinct, I feel, honor in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This takes me back 4 years ago because I didn't know what to say then, and I'm not real sure what to say now. Back then, I wanted to say, and I thought, I can't say that, and I got up there and said it. But this, tonight, you're going to hear the little old lady from Pasadena, and here she is, Sybil.
But I'm not wearing tennis shoes. Pasadena with tennis shoes. Hi, everybody. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I'm an alcoholic. When I say I love Little Rock, you know why I love Little Rock. This is my third or fourth time here in a couple of years. Third, maybe. Maybe I'm stretching it when I say four. But I do dearly love the AA members in Little Rock. The friendliest bunch of people I've ever known anywhere. The lovingest, the kindest, the best. And I expect soberest. I don't think that's a word, is it? But that's what you are. And you've been so good to me. And I think of you. I have never forgotten my first trip here when Margaret met me and we went to Hot Springs. And that's where I first met Beth and Jean. And I've made friends that had the privilege of meeting Jean and Gerald in Los Angeles a month or two ago. And I hope you folks, any of you who come to Los Angeles, will give me a call when you do get there and give me at least an hour's notice so I can clean up my house and let you come over and have coffee and we'll go to a meeting or something. Because you heard me tell what a rotten housekeeper I am, and if the doorbell rings, I just break out in a sweat if I look around and see all the litter I've created. I'm not an orderly person, but like I say, all AAs are welcome if I just know they're coming. And Bob, my husband, and I love to be with our own people, and that's one of the big reasons that we're sober. It's 4 o'clock in Hawaii, and in 4 hours he'll be doing the same thing I'm doing. He's talking at the banquet there at 8 o'clock. And it took me quite a while to figure out the difference in the time. It took me 2 watches, really. I'm just not that bright. But that's what he'll be doing, and we'll be talking these things over tomorrow night. He'll be home about 10:30. I leave early in the morning, and I'll go home. But I won't need a plane, really, to go home. I feel like I could just fly. It's been the best weekend that I can ever remember having. It just all just is so perfect. The little gatherings that we had, the lunches, and the daytime meeting today with the women, and the thing about Clancy and his birthday cake, which to me was beyond anything that I had expected, because I've known Clancy ever since he got sober. I was working in the central office when Clancy got sober. And he wasn't so macho and cool then, and he sounded a little timid. And the phone would ring, and I'd answer, and I'd say, Alcoholics Anonymous, can I help you? And he'd say, oh, this is Clancy Emerson. And he'd ask for whatever it was and make it as brief as possible, and his voice would be timorous and a little shaky, and he was new. And it was just a telephone voice at first. I was telling some people today that you make friends over the telephone, and they're real friends, good friends, and you love them, but you might not see them for a year or two when you work in the central office, but they're voices that you know so well. And that's the way it was with me. And Clancy, his voice, I knew a lot better than I ever knew the man. That came later. And the longer that I've known him, the more I love him. Because I see people all the time there when I go to the Pacific group that would be dead now. that couldn't possibly have gotten sober anywhere else, under any other circumstances. He takes on the helpless, hopeless rejects that some of us have tried to help and we failed to do it. And he has that, and that's a great gift. And I've only known one other man that had that great gift of being able to help those that other people have given up on, or will say, well, he can't make it, he's too far gone, or she can't make it. And my brother, Tex, who came in AA shortly after I did, had that knack of being tender with those that needed to be very, very tender with, or to be tough with you till you get here in the morning, if he thought they needed that. And whatever method it takes, they seem to have a knack of knowing what to say to these individuals. And I blunder along and do the best I can, but I don't have that knack of knowing how to handle all the 12-step calls that I go on. I do the best I can, and some of them get sober, and some of them don't. I don't get many 12-step calls these days. I used to make them. I'll tell you about that. I was fortunate enough to come in Alcoholics Anonymous in March of 1941 as a result of the Saturday Evening Post article. You have the cover framed back there. And I had the most terrible hangover you ever heard of. I'm sure you had your own, and it was the worst, too. But I was dying, and I knew it, and I had given up hope. And when I had a Turkish bath to get over the shakes so that I could go home and cook up some lies to my family, and I'd used them all the lies in the world, I didn't know what to say to them when I got home, and I dreaded it so much. I dreaded seeing my little girl, tiny little beautiful girl, because my guilt and remorse was so keen at being that kind of a mother that would take off and get drunk, leave my real estate office and maybe get in the car, as I did that time on my last run, and go up to San Francisco, where I didn't know a soul, and get there at daylight, and hung over and still drunk on a bottle in the car, and cry a while and throw up a while and then get back in the car and try to drive home and couldn't, and picked up a hitchhiker on the ridge route, which to Californians is a familiar thing. It's a bunch of mountains you go across to get back to Los Angeles, and at that time the roads were really bad. We didn't have the freeways. And I picked up a hitchhiker and crawled in the back seat and went to sleep. Next thing I know, he said, "Lady, we're in Los Angeles. I'm leaving you now." Nice man. He did a good job of driving the car. And I crawled out of the car and saw this sign, Turkish bath, and I thought that'll give me time to get better and then go home, which I did. But the miracle of it was that I picked up that Saturday Evening Post to read it to get my mind off my problems, and on the cover it said Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember right now, I get goose pimples when I think about it. I really do. And my hands get wet with sweat. I remember what a shock it was to me to see those large letters at the bottom of that cover saying Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'd heard of it in 1939 and needed help then. Small article in Liberty that didn't amount to a thing, really. It was okay. It was two paragraphs long. I think it was by Fulton Osler, and it was called Alcoholics and God. And he wound up this small article about that there is help for some people in the East where a small group of men are meeting together regularly, and they call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I read that, that was terribly impressive, more impressive than any pamphlet that we have today. And I thought, a group of men in New York meeting regularly to talk together and be together and try to quit drinking, and they're doing it, and they call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to find them and stay drunk for another 2 years. And when I found that magazine 2 years later, I thought, I've got my second chance. I thought I'd lost it forever, and if I'm going to do anything, it better be now. And so I rang the bell for the attendant and wrote a very pitiful letter saying, I'm a desperate woman alcoholic. Please help me. And I'll come back there immediately on the next plane. Please write me. Let me know what to do. I went home, made it up with the family one way or the other. Have no memory of any of that. The only memory I have is that I waited eagerly for an answer, and it came quickly. The drama of that is far greater today than it was then, because now I know personally and well, I know this lady personally, love her to death, and see her on quite a few occasions. Ruth Hawk, to any of you who have read AA Comes of Age, Ruth Hawk, the little 24-year-old girl that had worked for Bill Wilson, our founder, and his partner, Hank Parkhurst, who didn't get sober and stay sober, but was terribly important in getting Bill to write the book. She worked for them both for $25 a week at that time. There's no AA, you understand. And so when they began to work with drunks, she was right there, and if there was a call or anything, Ruth took it. And if there was a letter to write, she wrote it. And they didn't have any money to pay her. And then eventually when they decided they'd had to have a name and write a book, they offered to sell, instead of paying her $25 a week, they offered to give her stock in this new thing, Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came out and she came out to California to visit her daughter, who is a member of AA. And that's the reason she came out. And she said, I'll give you one day to me. I'm very shy and I'm afraid of crowds, so don't overdo it. I'll give you one day. She said, I haven't been out in public. I retired in Marietta, Ohio with my husband, who's an alcoholic. And I haven't been out anywhere around AA since we got married in right after the book was written. And she said, so I'm scared, witless, and make it easy on me if you're going to get some people together. And I had 3 days to do it. And I called up my friends. Like I said, Jean, you can bring two people. Beth, you can bring two people. And I called as many as I could. And we filled the Windsor Hall. There were 250 there. And I didn't overdo it, but it wouldn't have held anymore anyway. And I had lunch with her and some other girls, and we came in, and I got up and said, this is not an AA meeting. This is an AA happening. The lady that is responsible for our sobriety to a great degree, and every degree as far as I'm concerned, is here with us today, who was there when they wrote the book. And she typed it, and she told us that day that Bill would work out a page on a yellow ledger sheet and stand right there at the typewriter where she was typing, saying, here, Ruthie. He called her Dutch, and she would type that or type away on that. And then he would get the pages together and correct them and so forth, and he would just hand it to her page by page, and she did every bit of it. And finally, they got a letter from a guy in California on Alvarado in a sanitarium. And he said, I need help, and please help me. I've heard of you through, I don't know how he heard, but I'm desperate, and I've got to have some help, but I'm so far away, and I'm in a hospital here, and I don't know what to do. And they phoned there and asked his permission to put his story in the book. They said, we have finished our book, but we'll add a chapter if you will give us that permission. And he said, sure. And he told him his story. And Bill turned to Ruth and said, I've got important business to do, Ruthie. Write up his story. It was called The Lone Endeavor. Well, afterwards, he got drunk right away, and that was the end of him. And they had to take his chapter out of the book. But the odd thing was, when they printed a few more, the odd thing was, my brother Tex and I had gotten sober at that time, and we were making 12-step calls like crazy, and we got a call to go see this guy in the hospital. We didn't know that he had anything to do with getting his chapter in the book or anything. We went over and gave him our best shot, you know, and he didn't make it. And Ruth told us so many things that day that she talked forever in a day and then threw it open to questions. And the hands just flew up. They wanted to know all kinds of little things. And she would tell them that Bill would come up the stairs with a new drunk and make him kneel down at her desk where she was just trying to make him pray over him. And she said they were very powerful back there then. They had to pray a lot. They didn't like it. They were just too bad, but that's what they did. And she told us all these little ins and outs, which to me was just precious, because here I am back there in 1941. I know nothing except that the letter was signed R. Hawk, my plea for help. And it said, you don't have to come back to New York because you have AA there in California and you didn't know it. It started in December of 1939. You see, that was the last month of 1939, and here it is, 41. And she said, they've had a terrible time. Four men got hold of the book. They were in a hospital. Just the county hospital is where they were. They were dying men. They had to take them in because they were dying, and they didn't. And so they got hold of this big red book, passed it around among themselves in the ward there, and were discharged about the same day, and took each other's names and agreed to meet and did in the lobby of a hotel for a while. And these four men, when they got out of the hospital and they sat there in that hotel lobby, said, what do we do now? The book here doesn't tell us what to do about starting a group or anything. And one of those four men said, well, there is a chapter in there now, and I remember it well. It says how it works. So that'll tell us. So here, Hal, you read it. Hal Silverton was one of the fellows, became one of my great friends. And so Hal Silverton turned to chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path and on to the steps, you see. And every week that's what they did. They read that, the fifth chapter. So from 4 to 8 to a few when I came in, they were still doing it. And it grew, and it got big because of the Saturday Evening Post article. And within 60 days, we had moved three times, and now there were about 300 of us. And it was happening. It was just happening so fast that it was overwhelming. But when she told me where the meeting was, I went down there with great hope. I had absolute faith that this was going to keep me sober. I don't know why. I just thought this is it. And I went down there just dewy-eyed with joy and very nervous and shaking, and I had a nervous twitch and a red bandana tied to keep my hair out of the way, and I was so sick. My non-alcoholic husband, who had never had a short beer in his life, drove me down there, a well-dressed businessman. And we went to the Elks Temple where Ruth had told us to go, and they directed us into a little room, a little bitty room, where that they just had a table like AAs are used to, a long pine table where you sit around, somebody sits at the end. A few men were seated there, and I sat down, put my head down, and I didn't look up because I was petrified. I had concluded they were doctors, and that they would have some, they'd hand me, say, yes, we hear you wrote to New York, and so you take three of these a day with a glass of water, and you'll be cured. I didn't know. Alcoholism, didn't that word didn't mean a thing to me. I just didn't want to drink, and I figured they had the answer. But after a bit, a man got up at the end of the table and said, this is a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of ex-drunks who gathered together to obtain, maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. Oh, isn't that an awful thing to say to somebody scared to death? Oh. He didn't say a band of men and women. He said, we are a band of men who have gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis with no mental reservations whatsoever. And that's what they had to, you know, swear to get in, I guess. I don't know, because when he said that, that was the end of me. I thought, I can't do that. I said, what an order. What an order. I can't go through with it. That all probably took, I don't know, a few seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds or something like that, and I was mad. I sat there, just my face got red, and I was mad to hear that. But he continued, see, because they had a little way they lead a meeting. But he says, but as is our custom, before the regular meeting starts, the women will have to leave. And there I'm sitting where Beth is. And I knew they were throwing me out because I didn't fit in. And I knew that I never did fit in school. I was always an oddball. I couldn't make friends, and I was scared in school. Started drinking when I was 15. I was almost 33 at this time I'm telling you about, and I'd been terribly drunk for 17 years and doing all the wrong things at the wrong time and didn't want to behave that way, and all I wanted out of life was to be a good wife and mother, and I couldn't be. And I felt such shame and remorse that I cannot describe it to you, and I just didn't want to live anymore. Actually, could not stand myself. And here they were throwing me out, and I'd had that great hope. So I got up and put my hands over my face, and I ran out of the room and went out in this huge lobby and just cried and carried on, wrung my hands. But Dick sat where Gina's sitting, and he stayed because he was a man, and they said, well, the women will have to leave the room. And they thought he was a new baby, and they didn't get many there. The impact of the Saturday Evening Post hadn't hit, so they didn't have a crowd there, you know. And my letter got there and was answered, and I was there, and the mail hadn't come in. And he sat there, and I was out there walking up and down for hours because they were in no hurry. They didn't look at any watches or clocks, and they talked their hearts out to each other because they knew they wouldn't see each other for another week. And I thought I would die until that door opened, and they came out, and I ran over to Dick, and I said, well, give me my pills. I'm dying, and take me home. He said, Sib, you'll never know what I've been through. Well, I got hysterical, and I had no more hope. And when he took me home, I went to a bar, and I got very, very drunk and got 86 thrown out on the street. And then I remembered that I had the letter in my purse that Ruth Hawk had written me. My intentions were that I would pull out a letter from headquarters, which was very impressive now. You know, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, signed by R. Hawk. I thought it was Richard Hawk. And I was going to pull this on these guys and say, here are my credentials from the home office in New York, you know. And they would have to let me in. And I'd never gotten a chance to even show them my letter. So now that I'm thoroughly staggering, falling down drunk, I remembered the letter, and at the bottom of that letter it said, P.S., if you need help, call Cliff Walker, who was written up in your book, AA Comes of Age. And he had taken all the 12-step calls for California. No central office, naturally not, but anyone who wanted to know anything about it or anyone who called up or among themselves Cliff and Dorothy answered the phones in their home. And that's New York Hattie's number for that, and they gave it to me in that letter. And so I put a nickel in the telephone, paid telephone out in front of the bar, and called Cliff, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and he was just leaving to go and peddle milk. He had to deliver it before daylight. And in the Saturday Evening Post, they had shown a man, a picture of him on a stretcher being put in an ambulance, and I concluded it was an AA hospital, that it was an AA hospital cure. And then I saw the picture, next picture in the Saturday Evening Post showed the man in bed, and 2 men were sitting there by his bed talking to him. So I thought, yeah, it's an AA cure in a hospital in New York. That's the only place you can get it, you see. So when I called Cliff, I wanted to be like that man. They were picking up on the stretcher and taking over to the hospital. I said, send your AA ambulance and pick me up. And he said, you're drunk. I said, of course. I said, I tried to get into your exclusive club and they threw me out. He said, you've made a terrible mistake. I said, no, I have not. And I was very haughty. I was so drunk that I was haughty. I got that way at times. And so he said, well, we don't go to bars or outside of bars at 2 o'clock in the morning and pick up drunks. You've got the wrong idea about this thing. Now, he said, did you tell them you were a woman alcoholic? I said, certainly not. Well, I couldn't. Listen, I was so scared, and I was such a mouse when I was sober. I could no more walk into a room full of strange men and walk around the room like we do these days and say, hi, my name is Sybil, and I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't have done that. And so he said, well, now, you didn't tell him you were an alcoholic, and there's been a terrible mistake because occasionally a few wives go down there. I haven't been able to go down there for a while because I work nights now, so I have a Sunday afternoon meeting in my house. So the wives, if they go, sometimes they don't. But if they do, they mingle around in there, and they chit-chat, you know, until the meeting starts. And then the leader always says, and as is our custom, the women will have to leave. And the wives are used to it, and they stroll on out in the lobby and sit down and wait. And obviously, those women that I had seen sitting on a davenport out there knitting were sitting there talking about their husbands, I guess. There was no Al-Anon. This couldn't have happened today with Al-Anon, but there was no Al-Anon, and so therefore they thought my husband was a member, and they talked to him but wouldn't talk to me. They didn't mean to throw me out. Cliff said, you sober up and go back down there next Friday. As hurt as I was, you see, I feel like that I was absolutely divinely guided to go back there because I was not the kind of a person that could take that kind of treatment and being so horribly embarrassed and everything and go back, but my big brother came over who denied he was an alcoholic, but insisted on going back that following week to look them over to see how they were making money. He figured they were all getting in on some kind of a take, and it was a racket. And he insisted he'd go, and I said, they'll throw you out, too. And he said, no, they won't, because I won't open my mouth. And I said, well, you better make darn sure you don't, because I wanted that second chance at that outfit. So by this time, he'd been reduced from considerable wealth down to having a produce house and a couple of vegetable trucks that peddled vegetables out in the suburbs around potatoes and winos that would gather around wanting a job. And he said, well, those bums never show up. They're all in jail. And if this thing can help you, Sib, you're an example of the worst drunk I've ever seen in my whole life. And I want to watch what it can do for you. And if it can help you, I'm going down to see those people. And then I can take all my winos down there and get them sobered up and buy a fleet of trucks. And in 6 months, I'll be rich again. And that's all my interest is in it, he said. So he went down there with me. And they'd set up some chairs by this time in expectations of the results from New York. And so Tex pulled up in front of my house to take me down there. And he had brought his vegetable truck. And standing up in the back were 11 winos. And I get in that truck with my brother Tex. And we go on down to the mother group. And we sat down in that big, long row, and there were actually more of us than there were of them. And I folded my arms there. I knew I had my letter with me, and I knew that Cliff had straightened things out. He had phoned them and told them that a woman alcoholic had been down there the week before, and they were just devastated, really. Frank Randall was a magnificent man with an eloquent personality, and I was terribly nervous, and I didn't listen to what they read out of the book. I didn't hear the steps. I was self-concerned about my ability to stay in that room. By God, I'm going to stay. I'm told I can stay by Cliff. He told that man up in front, who's probably close to God, that I can stay. And so eventually he went through this rigmarole, which didn't mean a thing to me. I don't know whether newcomers, I didn't hear anything that was going to help me. I didn't hear that. I just couldn't. But I got very interested when Frank left the podium and went up, like, over there and came back with a big brown carton full of letters from New York that had arrived. had been mailed from New York there because of the Saturday Evening Post article, and that mail came in bushel baskets, and there were 5 or 612-step calls to make immediately. And you can bet I got interested when I saw this big man, Frank. He looked, he was a tall, well-dressed man. He said, "Here it is, you jokers. Any of you who've been sober 15 minutes, come up here and get these 12-step calls that have been mailed to us from New York. Because alcoholism is a disease, and it's a killer, and if you don't make these calls this week and bring these guys down here, some of them could die. So I have bundled them up according to where you live. I have some here from Santa Barbara, some from Fresno, some from Orange County, and some from San Bernardino, and a lot of them in Glendale and Pasadena and downtown Los Angeles, everywhere there can be a drunk in California. We got a letter here. So according to where you live, I'm gonna hold up a bundle and say it, and then you raise your hand if you're anywhere in the area." And he began that way, and I was interested. And he said first, "Is anybody here from San Bernardino or Riverside County?" And Kent Hayden raised his hand. "Here." And so he went up and he got about 50 or 60 all tied up with twine. And he went through that. Orange County, Mel Trickey, real estate broker, went up and got a huge stack. And so on. Curly O'Neill happened to be there from Long Beach. He said, "Anybody from the beaches?" And he meant from Laguna Carron down to San Pedro. And Curly O'Neill said, "Here." And he went up and got all the beaches to take care of. And he did this till he got out of the last stack of letters, about 50 or 60, and he said, "I saved these to the last because they're all from women alcoholics who are asking for help, and according to Cliff, we've got one here tonight, and I think you're it. Are you Sybil Maxwell?" Which was my married name at that time, and I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I thought so. So come on up here, Sybil, because I'm going to put you in charge of all the women." And it really, really, the way that hit me, sitting there as scared as I was, with tears in my eyes and shaking, and I had dug my fingernails into my hand, and there were little half moons of blood and half healed. Just hang on. And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, come up here." I said, "Come up here and get these 12-step calls." And I got up there, and it's just shaking, and I looked up at him. He was so tall. And I said, "I can't do that, sir." He looked at me and he says, "Why not?" I said, "Well, because you said that they had to be made by next Friday, that some of them might die if we didn't make them. And I'm not dependable. I'll be drunk by next Friday." And I had to tell him that. And so I better not do that. I don't want to be responsible for anybody dying. And I said, "Unless that before I leave here tonight, sir, that you can tell me what you're doing to stay sober, because truthfully, nobody's told me how you're doing it yet." And they hadn't. And I wonder if ever a newcomer comes to AA now and wonders, "Why didn't somebody tell me how they're doing it? What are you doing? What are you doing?" And I've been there, you know, a long time wondering about it. I hadn't heard anything. They hadn't told me how to do it. "Well, no," he said, "you ask if it was a miracle. Not exactly, but you could almost say that it is, but not in those words." He said, "We just go by this big red book here because we started AA in California here without any instructions from any of the wiser men in the East, whom we've never met. And we read it, and we believe what it says, and here on page so-and-so," I'll say page 26, "our founder, Bill Wilson, whom you'll hear about all the time, says, when all other measures fail, working with another alcoholic will save the day." And he says, "That's what you'll be doing, see?" He said, "Our founder says that when you work with another alcoholic," he said, "I'll never forget," he pointed his finger right at my nose, he said, "Sybil, get your mind off yourself and help somebody else. That's what it means." And I said, "I can do that." And so he gave me the big stack of letters. And I believed him. I just believed him thoroughly. And I looked up at him again, and I said, "But what'll I say?" He says, "When I call on the girl." He says, "Well, ring that doorbell. When she comes to the door, you hand her the letter she wrote. She'll recognize her own handwriting." And I said, "Yeah, but what'll I say?" He says, "Very little. You don't know anything." He said, "Just hold out the letter and say, 'Did you write this and ask for help for a drinking problem?'" I did. I wrote one like that. And she said, "Yeah, that's me. That's my letter." "Well, they got my letter last week and they sent me to get you. So if you want to get sober like I want to get sober, come with me and we'll just have to find out together." He says, "That's a 12-step call." And I've got a pet gripe that I state publicly sometimes when I think of it, and I will at this point. In recent years, very recent years, they make the Central Service Committee in Los Angeles, and then I've checked with other service offices, not here, not in Little Rock, I haven't checked. They have now made a rule, they made the rule here last year, 2 years ago in Los Angeles, that a person had to be sober 1 year before they could make a 12-step call from the central office. And I think that stinks. And the groups didn't like it much, and so they had another Central Service Committee, and they have now reduced it to 6 months. And I still think that stinks. Because how long had Bill been sober when he called on Dr. Bob? How would AA have been born? How would we be here tonight? If when Bill worked with 75 drunks down on Skid Row in the Bowery and then jails, and not one of them would listen to him, and he went home one day and said, "Lois, I'm giving it up. Nobody will stay sober. I'm a failure." And she said, "Bill, you're not a failure. You're a great success. You've been sober 6 months, longer than you've ever been sober since we've been married." And he said, "My golly, Lois, you're right. I guess I'll give it another shot." And he did. And it wasn't long till he went over to Akron and he got one, Dr. Bob. And there were two. And they went over to the hospital and called on Joe Warden, and there were three. And then you know the story of Sister Ignatia and how he stayed there and lived at Dr. Bob's house. And he finally went back to New York, and he had a little bunch of them, and they had those in Akron, and they were off and running. Slowly, of course, no publicity. And they grew just from working with other alcoholics. And I think that any alcoholic, and I mean they didn't, what if Bill, on that day there, or well, we'll make this up because it isn't true, it didn't happen, but suppose that Bill is there in New York and somebody would walked up to him after, oh, a little while, he was doing this thing and it just started it, we'll say, and somebody had walked up to him and said, "Hey, Bill, I hear there's a famous surgeon over in Akron that's dying of this alcoholism. They call him Dr. Robert Smith. And I think you ought to go over and try to help him." And Bill would say, "Well, let's see. I've only been sober 2 or 3 weeks. In about 6 months, possibly a year, I'll go over and talk to the man." Wouldn't that have been a terrible thing if Bill had thought that he had to wait a certain length of time and try this thing out before he went to work with another alcoholic? I'm so grateful and so thankful that he went over when he did, and that he persevered and he endured, as we endure, no matter what happens, and kept their sobriety. And I was just captivated by that story, to think that that's what they did. They worked with other alcoholics, and that's the way they stayed sober. And then, of course, they read the book and practiced the steps. But working with other alcoholics, I think any alcoholic now, tonight, if he knows of a drunk that needs help, I don't care if you've been sober 15 minutes, 15 days, or 15 years, you can take somebody with you if you're frightened of going or nervous about it. Take somebody with you. Take Gerald, take Gene, take anybody with you. It's not that big a deal. They're so glad to see you as a rule, and the worst they can say is no. No, thank you. You say, okay, call me if you need me, and that's about the end of it. The only way that I know that we can grow and stay sober is to go see people who need help or they will die. And we should be allowed to do it in our own good time without any motions being made and carried and voted on. And that's the end of that. But anyway, I'm sober and I'm in charge of the women. And I'm bossy and I'm told that I can, you know, they got to do what I tell them. And I go to the meetings and instead of just me, handing out these, I made the 12-step calls, got a little bunch of them, and then pretty soon there were 30 or 40, and I knew there were because Beth would have to go see Susie, and there's that Susie, so she's the sponsor, and Susie's the sponsee. Yep, that matches. And there's two over here, and I'd given her that call. Yeah, she did the job there. She brought that girl, and I had it all in a book, all the sponsors and sponsees and their phone numbers, and I'm in charge. And I go to the meeting, and I can count off my list, and it matches, and so it's a good system, and it's keeping me sober, and I'm so important that it's just beyond telling you how important I felt that I was in charge. And then one night, back in the hall here, here came Kay Riley, and then back of her, following her in a long trail, were five women. And I looked them over, and they were all strangers, and none of them had been cleared through me. And I noticed that right away, and so I just walked right back there to her with my book. And I said, "Kay, where'd you get those women?" She said, "It's none of your business, Sybil, but I don't mind telling you, they're neighbors of mine in Culver City that I used to play cards with when I was sober enough, and we drank a lot together for many years, and they watched me, saw me stay sober, asked how I was doing it, and I told them, and they said, 'Let us go, too, we want this thing,' and I said, 'Sure, come along,' and they did, and that's the way it is, that's the way it's going to be. And I'm never, ever going to do anything you tell me to do again, Sybil." And I got the tears back in my eyes and my nerves twitched and it nearly killed me. And I went back out to the hole in the ground because my brother had been excommunicated because he started a group. He laughed at him about that. They didn't like that big fat Texan who started a group. They walked up to him when he started the hole in the ground, which was at the halfway point between the mother group and downtown. And they heard about it. He just met in my house and somebody else's house till he had a little bunch of people. And we went down to Long Beach on Wednesdays and met in a home down there. And then we'd go downtown Friday. But when they heard that he'd rented a hall and started another group, we walked, went in one night and they walked up to him, about four of them, and they said, "We have taken a vote and we don't want you. You're disloyal to this program and to your mother group that has given you your sobriety, so you are excommunicated." And he said, "You can't do that." And they said, "But we have, because Gerald here is an attorney, and we asked him to do us a favor and draw up papers to incorporate Alcoholics Anonymous against this kind of thing. And we have incorporation, we have corporation papers which we can show you tonight that Alcoholics Anonymous is incorporated in California, and you can't start a group without our permission." And the text says, "I can't." "Well, I have, and it's going to be okay, because," he said, "you might as well try to incorporate a sunset." He said, "I'll lay you 8 to 5, and 6 months we'll have 50 groups scattered around here. So, folks, I'm going to sit down and enjoy the meeting. I'll be too busy to come down here much because of my group, but when I get good and ready, I'm going to come back any time I please." You see, we had no tradition, so we made terrible mistakes like that. And it's a wonder that we didn't destroy ourselves. But we didn't. It was terribly exciting, I can tell you that. But we stayed sober, and it was fun, and I thought that since I was sober and all that, that life would always be just like that, and nothing bad could ever happen. But this wonderful non-alcoholic man that I had married in some tough days of my life when that baby was born and during the Depression, and I couldn't get a job, and I was finally forced to go to work, and so that I could take care of her, she was staying with my mother because I was too drunk to have a home. Her father had deserted me when she was born. He was a drunk, and he's a good boy, too. But he went back to his folks in New York. And it was okay. He was a good boy, but he just left. Things were too tough, and he couldn't work, didn't have any money. And it had been that way with us a long time, and I had the baby, and so Mama kept her because I couldn't. And I wanted to be self-supporting, and I couldn't find a job, so I went down to a taxi dance hall, and you young people don't even know what that is. That's a dime a dance hall where the girls dance with you for a dime, and the music will run about 20 seconds, and it stops, and you're out of dime. And then you get a string of tickets, and that's the way it is, and you just dance, and the music stops, and then they get another partner, and so forth. And I did that night and hated it and got drunk, and they had an intermission where you could get a pitcher of beer, and I drank all I could hold in order to do this thing. But a very well-dressed man kept buying long strings of tickets, and he only danced with me. And, I mean, you had to buy a long string of tickets to dance with anybody 20 minutes. And he bought me beer, and I cried. "By this time, I'm good drunk, and I want my baby, and I want to be a good wife and mother, and look at me, what I've become. Here I am working in this taxi dance hall, and I'm really a nice person, but I can't get sober, and I don't know what I'm going to do, and I just can't stand being here, and I don't want to be like that." And I'd been a bootlegger before that and didn't think a thing about it, so. With my brother Tex. We drank up all the stuff, and the cops would arrest him and haul him off to jail, and I'd just sit there and drink up the booze. But at any rate, during intermission, when I was giving him this sad tale, which was entirely true, I didn't want to be there, he said, "Oh, little girl, you're too nice to be in a terrible joint like this." And he said, "All you need is security. Imagine financial security with a darling little baby and everything." He said, "I can offer you that, honey." He said, "I'll take good care of you, and you won't have to drink. And if you promise me you won't drink, well, I'll take care of your child, and I'll adopt her and be a good father to her. So let's get married." And I said, "Oh, let's do." And we did, and I was drunk in a week. And when I found out, he drove me down there. I told you that. The little girl, it was growing and getting bigger, and I'm still drunk. And it hadn't improved the situation at all to live in a huge, beautiful home with 3 bathrooms and 4 bedrooms and a huge dining room and an oriental rug and damask furniture and everything. It didn't make any difference. I was worse than I'd ever been, and I did not know why. I just didn't know why. But now I'm going to the meetings, and I'm coming home, and he's sitting in the rocking chair in that beautiful room, and he's sitting there with his chin jutted out, sour. "Again," he'd say, meaning you've been to the meeting again. I'd say, "Oh, honey, I promised I wouldn't go so much, and I will cut back on those AA meetings. I really will. I'll really be a good wife. I just won't go as much. I promise I won't." And I'd kneel down where he was sitting and put my head in his lap and cry and say, I'll stay home until next Saturday night, and then I'll go to a meeting. But some girl would call up, or somebody give me a 12-step call, and I'd have to take the girl, or whatever would come up, and I'd go to the meeting, and I'd come home, and he'd be sitting in the rocking chair, and he'd say, again? And I'd go through that again. Full of... And then I got to thinking, well, gee, I'm doing the same thing I used to when I came home drunk. I'd say, gee, I'm sorry I went to that bar. I meant to come home after one beer, and I won't do it again. Oh, honey, please forgive me. Now I'm saying, please forgive me for going to AA so much. And I couldn't take that. So I came home from the meeting the next night, and he had a smile on his face, and he said, honey, I've got the solution to our marriage. And by golly, I said, gee, let's talk about it. I said, turn on the light in the living room, and let's sit down, and I want to know what it is. And he said, well, I got to thinking. He said, now, and this will work, he said. If you'll go back to drinking like it was in the good old days, I'll take care of you, and it'll be better than this. I couldn't believe my ears. And I looked at him, and I didn't speak, and my whole being was just, I was just all astir. I couldn't speak, and I had a bad temper, and instead of throwing dishes or screaming or hollering or fighting or quarreling or anything else, I stood there like stone, stunned, really. I finally went upstairs, and I got a little suitcase, and I packed what I could. I left my new car right there in the driveway. And my daughter was 16 and had just gotten married. Too young, but we couldn't prevent it. She wanted to get married. She did. Didn't work out, but that's another story. She's happily married now and a member of AA, so we're almost 2 years, she and her husband both. And I left. And I didn't take anything. And I just picked up my purse with whatever money was in it, and I went down to Adams and Figueroa, a rooming house section. It was some old mansions that had been turned into housekeeping rooms. It had been a fine section. And I rented a housekeeping room there with a gas plate and a bathroom across the hall for $7 or $10 or $12 a week. I don't remember. And I went down to the Times newspaper, big newspaper there in Los Angeles, got a job the next day. I could always find work. I was a good secretary. I was a legal secretary for many years. I was a Jill of all trades. I had no problem getting the job. But I was so hurt. And I was so lonely. And there was a big church there on the corner on Figueroa. And those church bells would ring on the hour. And I would hear the bell toll. And I would weep. And I couldn't stand it. And I walked down the hall one day, and the door was open. Long hall to get out the front door, and the door was open. And a woman was lying there on a bed. And I said, hi. And she said, hi. And I walked back from work the next day, and I saw the bottles on the floor. And I went in to speak to her, and I told her I was a member of AA, and did she want some help? She said, no, I've been drinking since about, December the 1st. What is this? And I said, January the 15th. And she said, well, I started this about in December before Christmas, or maybe it was Thanksgiving. So I'd walk by her door every day, and it'd be open, and she wasn't getting up, and the bottles were getting higher, and I didn't know, I guess the fellows living upstairs bought the bottles, I don't know, but her door would be open. And then she called me in one day, and she was in terrible shape, and she said, Mom and Daddy are coming from Kansas to get me and take me home. And I talked to them on the phone today, and they've already left, and they're going to take me home, and I'm going to be all right. But, Sybil, you've been good to me, and I don't want your AA. I don't want that. I don't need that. I just need to go home with Mom and Daddy. So will you go down and get me a half pint so I can get out of bed and be on my feet when they get here? And I said, no, I never buy a drink for a drunk. That's a pledge I made myself. A drunk can always find a bottle. I won't do that. Oh, please, Sybil, I need so much. I need so much to get out of this bed and get a bath. And please go. And so I did. I went down to the corner liquor store and bought her a half pint, and I went back and sat it down. She had the sink at the end there, just like in my room. And I told her good night, and I thought, did I do the right thing? Well, I think I did. I really think I did. And so in the morning before I went to work at the Times, I looked in to see how she was. She was dead. And I tell you, I was a bad situation. I nearly died. I killed her. I'm a murderer. I shouldn't have done it. I gave her a drink, and I didn't go to work. I caught a streetcar, and I went out to the hole in the ground, cried on everybody's shoulder, told them what I'd done. And they said, Sybil, you're not God. That girl was dead already. She wouldn't go to the hospital. She wouldn't go to AA. She'd been lying there 6 or 8 weeks, and she was too far gone. We had no treatment facilities and no treatment centers of any, no help for alcoholics then. They said, you did the best you could, and did you look to see if she ever got up and even got the bottle? They said, the chances are she didn't even drink it. She was dying of pneumonia, the type that gets you real quick when you're in that condition, which proved to be true. But I suffered over that, and I hurt, and I got over it because they really gave me the best they could out of that. And I went home to my home, my room, and I saw a man and a woman, a little woman with a little black hat on, a little veil and a feather, and a little man all humped over. And I could hear him say, "Well, I thought it was room 7, Daddy." And he says, "Well, maybe it isn't. We better ask the landlady." And I knew who it was. It was Mama and Daddy from Kansas. And to add to that day, I had to walk up to them and say, "She's gone." Now, that was tough for an alcoholic, and I'm making a big deal out of it, but it really was, and I heard over it and agonized over it a lot. But I found out that in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have to drink, that it isn't all going to be peaches and cream and a bed of roses. I found out that if Alcoholics Anonymous won't work under any circumstances, but only works when things are good, it wouldn't be worth a plug nickel to me. Because there were times when I was drinking that things were okay. I mean, everybody's had some times in their lives when things were okay. But I will be 76 next May. I will be 43 years sober in March. And through my experience, I have found that you can stay sober no matter what happens, because a lot of it has happened to me because I'm a human being, not because I'm a member of AA. I'm talking about tragedies like my brother dying right there at the meeting at the hole in the ground and not being able to cry. And he knew he was dying, but he lived for 5 years longer than the doctor said he could. And instead of crying, I didn't. And you know what that'll do? That'll kill you. And I was there, and there my brother was, and he was supposed to have been gone 5 years before that, but now he is gone, and I can't cry, and that got to me bad. I'd keep going to the meetings and smile and show my teeth. And Beth and Margaret and everybody say, "How are you, Sib?" "Oh, I'm fine. How are you?" "Well, that's good. We'd like to come over and see you." "Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so busy these days. You'll just have to make it another time." And I wouldn't let them come over, and some of them would try, and I'd say, "Oh, gee, I'm just going to the bank. You'll have to excuse me." And it would just be a brassy voice with no feeling, and I don't know. It was bad. And I finally couldn't take it, and I didn't know what the problem was, so I wrote a letter to Bill Wilson. I mean, another member wouldn't do. This was... Bill had been out to visit us many times there in California in the early days to see how his program was getting along. And I'd met him, talked with him, been with him, was fortunate enough to do that. And I wrote him a letter, and I told him all these feelings I've been telling you, that this was bad. And he answered immediately. Absolutely immediately. And he said, "Your letter has stirred me more than anything I can remember in recent years. I loved Tex too. But in God's house there are many mansions. And somehow or other, I see your brother Tex on the porch of one of those mansions in the sunlight, talking to another drunk. And that's as it should be. But as for you, my dear, I will tell you this, that life is but a long day in school. And some of our lessons will be easy, and some of them will be hard. And it's not so much what happens to us here, but it's what we do with those experiences. It's what we do with those experiences. It's the demonstration that counts." And I thought to myself, I guess what he means is that when we go through something that's bad, that it puts us in a position, possibly, to save another human being later on that may be going through something very similar. And that there's a reason for it and a purpose for it. And I've come to believe that. And I have endured. And I think I'm the most privileged person on earth to be asked to talk at meetings. Because for 10 years or 20 years, I couldn't. I was so timid. I was so shy. And I was so scared. First, my brother Tex worked on me and made me get up with a scrap of paper in my hand after several months of sobriety and read it to just a few little people. And when I got through, they applauded till the rafters came off because they knew I had this terrible problem of fear. And I remember when I sat down the first time, I sat in the second row or first row, I folded my arms and somebody put a cigarette in my mouth and I had uttered my first word and the applause kept up. And I remember thinking, "My God, was I really that good?" And I had to practice to get up and say anything. And each time it hurt less. War came along and I worked midnight shift and couldn't go to meetings. I had to sleep daytimes and be at work. And I had to start a daytime meeting in my home. And I had to have my medicine, even though I couldn't get to the hole in the ground, except maybe to just say hello and then cut out with my Levi's on and go over and be a welder. And I was a good mechanic, and I worked all through those years, and I didn't go to as much AA. And I have found that every time that I don't go to a lot of AA, I begin to go back to the old Sybil, and I get fearful, I get full of anxiety, and it's bad for me not to go to be with you and to have your hugs and kisses. And I whispered into someone's ear here today that was hugging me. I said, "Don't tell anybody, but I think the hugs and kisses are just as important as the 12 steps. And I do need a lot of love. I'll tell you why. Because if I don't get a lot of love from you, I need to have extra special love and attention just to feel average. You know, like maybe you feel all the time. Because if I didn't have it, I would finally get timid, and I'd get in the back row, and I would bite my fingernails and say, they don't like me, they don't want me here. And I just have to believe that you love me and that you want me here, and I do believe it. And I know that I haven't said anything probably that is earth-shaking. The thing about speaking is people will go in, they'll be on an uplift, and they'll say, wasn't it a wonderful meeting? And you'll go home and you'll tell your friends, oh, it was a wonderful meeting. Well, what did he say? He said, he was really good, though. He was really good. Yeah, well, what did he say? Well, he talked about drinking, and he was against it. And that's about the way it is. But I've had a glorious weekend here, and I don't like very much to have to get up at 5 in the morning and be out. I have a phobia. I have to be at the airport an hour before the plane leaves, as if that was the last plane on earth that was ever going to go anywhere. And that's the way it is, because my plane leaves at 7:30. And I don't want to go. I'm happy here, and I want to be with you, but I've got a lovely, warm, loving husband and 4 dogs and 3 cats that are waiting for me to come home and clean up the mess, that which I will do. But, you know, I think that seniority is a bad word. I don't want to be called an old-timer, and I'll poke anybody in the nose that would call me one, because I feel like a newcomer, and I know that I'm here to learn and keep on learning, and that's the only way it can possibly be. As a matter of fact, I think we should all call ourselves newcomers, because in the book it says, more will be revealed to us, and it is all the time. I think that we're like all of us, like little fledglings learning to fly. So as fledglings learning to fly, may the wings of your happiness never lose a feather. Thank you, and God bless you.